Harry could definitely put that long-accepted premise to rest. He discovered that you can't sleep when you're an old man. Greetings, folks. How are you? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I do appreciate you joining me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Wayne J. Gardner bring us our first story. It's called You Can Sleep When You're an Old Man. That's how they used to goad one another back in the day. Those many years ago, you can sleep when you're an old man. Usually said when they're up to no good. College boys heading down to the tavern at midnight. Young GIs on a weekend pass, anxious for an early start to explore the seamier sides of the city. Usually, two or three coaxing a reluctant buddy, comfortably ensconced in his bed. I need to get some sleep, he'd protest. And they would reply, get your butt up, you can sleep, you get it. Years later, Harry Maxwell, lying in bed with his eyes wide open, 4:30 in the morning, remembering the good-natured taunts. Sometimes he delivered them, sometimes he was on the receiving end, smiling at the recollection. Well, they'd believed it back then. Now, awake since 3:30 and past 80 years old, Harry could definitely put that long-accepted premise to rest. He discovered that you can't sleep when you're an old man. Well, at least Harry can't. But not for any reason he would have imagined those many years ago. Oh, he still has to get up to pee several times a night. That's a given. Harry can live with that. It's something else. It had been a shock to the whole family. What family wouldn't be shocked? It had been one thing after another for the Bryant family back then. First, Harry's sister-in-law Claire, his wife's sister, went missing. Then his brother-in-law Darryl Bryant was sentenced to life in prison for her murder. A chance of parole, but he didn't make it that far. Died in the prison infirmary. Heart attack. He was 45 years old, the same age as Harry. He'd put in 10 years, about half the time he needed before the parole board would review his case. Darryl had been nursing the granddaddy of all hangovers on that fateful day. Had slept till noon, finally rallying after a few therapeutic trips to the bathroom. He didn't consider it unusual on a Saturday for Claire to be out of the house. Shopping, errands, that kind of thing. He was surprised when she wasn't back for dinner. Darryl called her cell phone a few times. No answer. Tried her two best friends around 7 o'clock and then her mother. At 10 o'clock, he called the police. A search party discovered her body 2 days later. A remote spot in a heavily forested area less than a mile from Claire and Darryl's house. Murdered. Bludgeoned to death. The coroner's best guess? She died on Saturday, the same day she disappeared. The family dealing with all the uncertainty, all the anguish. Before the body was discovered, they had no way of knowing whether she had an accident, been abducted, or just ran off. No one wanted to voice that last opinion to others. There were no signs pointing to that possibility, but wasn't that sometimes a reason in situations like this? How can you really know what things happen in the privacy of someone's home? Harry didn't share his thoughts. They were too edgy for a family discussion, but Harry wondered if Darryl might have felt a sense of relief at the discovery of Claire's body. Now, he wouldn't have to hear the stigma of a man whose wife had left him. People talking about it out at the club, in the neighborhood, back at the office. Harry felt guilty even considering such a thought. The devastation on Darryl's face was unmistakable. Still, a man has his pride to consider. If Darrell had felt relief, it was short-lived. The police had questioned Darrell on the night she'd gone missing, but at that point it was routine, gathering whatever facts Darrell could provide. Still, no evidence of any wrongdoing at that point. But now, Harry knew the police would be bringing Darrell in for some serious questioning, knew they'd probably question everyone in the family, himself included. He'd given it a lot of thought. He'd called Darrell before they scheduled Darrell's interview. "We were together that morning," Harry said.
"What? Who was together?"
Harry said. "The two of us." Darrell, uncertain of which two people Harry might be talking about.
"You and me," Harry explained.
"What are you..." "Darrell, listen to me. What were you really doing that morning?"
"Oh, I was sleeping it off. You must know that. You and I were way overserved at the club."
Darrell and Harry were successful men. They routinely met at the bar at the country club on Friday nights. They traditionally took an hour or two at the end of the week to wind down from demanding high-pressure jobs. Normally, they'd have one or two. Not so on this particular night. Darrell's job as the manager of a successful shipping company was becoming more stressful. The level of pressure ramped up by the ownership in recent weeks at the rapid rise of a new competitor, making inroads into the business, beginning to convert some of Darrell's customers into their camp. The CEO, never a pleasant man, had made no effort to hide his dissatisfaction with Darrell's sliding revenue numbers. Darrell had to admit for the first time in his life that he had some concerns about his future. Harry, commiserating with his best friend, pacing himself at the bar as it became obvious that he would have to be the designated driver on the way home. Listening to Darrell tell him about a particularly notable confrontation with the boss late that afternoon, Darrell providing the details while ordering another Double Knob Creek on the rocks, it would have been euphemistically polite to say Darrell was just unwinding. He was hammered. Harry was glad they'd opted for a booth. Darrell might have fallen off a bar stool. When you tell the police you were sleeping off a drunk, how do you think they'll view that? The regret in Darrell's voice was evident and sincere.
"Oh, I know it's terrible to say. After we left the club, I don't remember a thing."
Harry said, "I understand that. I'm not so sure the police will." No answer from Darrell. "So you and I were up in Eagleton looking at that property. I picked you up at 7 in the morning."
"Looking at the property?" Darrell said.
Harry and Darrell had been scoping out a piece of land in an upstate town just over an hour from where they lived. 2 forested acres on a small mountain lake in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The idea? Start up a sports bar. Huge windows and a deck overlooking the pristine waters of the lake. Big screen TVs. Claire, with her good looks and winning personality, a perfect hostess. Harry went on. "We walked the property for over an hour, looked at possible sites to situate the building. Then we drove around the area, looked at access roads, traffic patterns, the town itself. Drove by the storefronts and restaurants doing business there. An hour to get up there, an hour back. It was afternoon when we got home."
"Looking at the property," Darrell said again, warming to the idea. Then, "Why are you suggesting this?"
"Or," Harry said sarcastically, "you can tell them you were sleeping off a drunk. Which one do you think will play better to a jury?"
"A jury?"
Darrell, apparently not yet allowing himself to realize what serious trouble he might be in. "They're going to take a hard look at you, Darrell."
"And you're willing to do this for me? To testify that we were up in Eagleton looking at real estate?"
Harry said, "Darrell, it's important to have an alibi in a circumstance like this."
"Well, it doesn't seem right to lie about it." Harry exhaled into the phone. Tell that to yourself when you're in the shower on death row, and a handful of 300-pound guys named Bubba tell you they think you're kind of cute. Daryl let that go without a response. The police had Daryl in for questioning the next day. The entire day. He didn't admit to the crime, but a week later the detectives and the DA were convinced they had enough evidence to make the arrest. They hauled a stunned Daryl away in handcuffs, making care to see that he didn't bump his head as they assisted him into the back seat of the cruiser. Only a few months later, the jury concurred with the state's position. Daryl was convicted and sent to the state penitentiary. The family, reeling with each successive blow, mourning for Claire, praying that Daryl wasn't responsible. And just like that, one branch of the family no longer existed. Not a branch that had been neatly pruned, more like one that had been hacked off with a dull blade, sap oozing, uneven, jagged remains protruding. It wasn't easy to move on from. Of all the family members, this whole thing had probably been harder on Harry than anyone else. He had genuinely liked both Daryl and Claire. He was the key witness for Daryl's defense. When the verdict was rendered, it left Harry feeling as if he had somehow failed the family, though no one expressed even an inkling of doubt that Harry's testimony was anything less than stellar. In fact, the family, after hearing Harry's testimony, allowed themselves to feel some optimism, feel that the tide may have begun to turn in Daryl's favor. The jury, apparently, not so much. It had been a heavy burden for Harry to carry all these years. The prosecution opened by bringing the coroner to the stand. Cause of death, estimated time. Some onlookers surprised that Daryl's attorney had no questions on cross-examination, but let the judge know he might want to recall him later. They had the murder weapon. Exhibit A laying right there on the table in the courtroom for everyone to see. A ball-peen hammer, still covered in dried blood and bloody tissue. The hammer was Daryl's. It had his prints on it. In the cross-examination of the detective who discovered it, Daryl's attorney scoffed. Well, of course it would have his prints on it. It was his hammer. We aren't contesting that. The detective, an impressive presence on the stand, a veteran of 20 years on the force, seeing no need to reply to that observation. Anyone else's prints on it? Daryl's attorney asked. The detective said, only his. It wouldn't surprise you, would it, detective, to discover that a hammer owned by the defendant, kept in his own home, would have his fingerprints on it? No, that wouldn't surprise me. And we can assume that you photographed and then bagged the hammer so that the prosecutor could introduce it into evidence here today? Yes. So you picked it up, put it in a bag? Yes. Are your fingerprints on it? They are not. Oh, because? I used rubber gloves so as not to taint any prints that were already there. Oh, an obvious and reasonable thing for you to do. You wouldn't want your prints intermingling with those already on the hammer. No. And if someone else were to have taken the hammer from his residence and were later to have wielded in the commission of this horrible crime, might that person have been intelligent enough to wear rubber gloves to keep their prints off the murder weapon? I can't answer a hypothetical question. Oh, no, that's okay, detective. I believe the members of the jury can arrive at their own conclusion. Daryl's attorney raising his eyebrows and shrugging toward the jury as if it were a no-brainer. Did you think it was unusual to find the murder weapon right there at the scene of the crime? Well, a murder weapon is often discovered at the scene of the crime. In this case, a hammer, obviously taken from the residence of my client, used to bludgeon the victim at a remote location in the forest, then left there?
Yes. Well, it seems like a careless thing for a perpetrator to do.
People do strange things in the commission of crimes. Did you consider whether some other person may have left the murder weapon at the scene in order to make it appear that my client had been the attacker?
The prosecutor was on his feet.
Objection, Your Honor, a hypothetical situation.
The judge said, This pertains to what the detective was considering at the time he evaluated the crime scene. I'll allow it.
That thought did cross my mind. So even though you often find a murder weapon at the scene of the crime, it may have seemed a little unusual in these circumstances.
Objection, Your Honor.
Darrell's attorney, having already made his point, said, That's all right, I'll withdraw it. Taking a few seconds to look at his notes as if he may have forgotten something. Did you have any additional suspects for this crime other than the defendant?
None that we deemed credible possibilities.
But did you have any other prospects?
The detective adjusted his position in the witness chair. Actually, we did not.
Not one single other suspect that you considered viable?
No.
Darrell's attorney flipped over a page in the yellow legal pad he was carrying. Did you interview Barbara Hackett?
Yes, we did.
Can you tell the jury who Barbara Hackett is?
She is the next-door neighbor of the victim and the defendant. She also stated that she and the victim were best friends.
Did Mrs. Hackett seem a credible person?
We had no reason to believe that she was not.
Did she have anything of interest to report to you?
A brief hesitation and a fleeting expression that suggested the detective would rather not have been asked this question.
I assume you were referring to a comment she made regarding a feeling she had, unsubstantiated, by her own admission, that the deceased may have been seeing someone outside the marriage.
Oh, seeing someone romantically.
That was the inference.
Did you look into this further?
We questioned her at length. She stated it was just a feeling. She had no evidence to confirm it. She couldn't articulate why she had such an impression.
Did you explore the possibility beyond that?
In the course of our investigation, we asked all the neighbors, members of the family, people she worked with. No one had any reason to believe that there were any problems in the Bryant household.
Except her best friend,
who could not point to any specific reason for thinking that to be the case.
So you dismissed that possibility.
We had no basis to continue down that road.
No further questions.
The prosecution rested their case after only 2 days of testimony. The defense then presented their case. A number of character witnesses were called to the stand. Neighbors, family members, co-workers, Darrell's secretary, an intelligent and efficient woman, president of the local PTA, all attesting to the fact that Darrell was a prince of a fellow and that, to their knowledge, Darrell and Claire were a model couple who had never exchanged a cross word with one another. Even Barbara Hackett, though she still maintained she had this feeling that something was amiss in the house next door, confirmed the detective's assertion that she had no specific evidence to substantiate her concern. After the day's proceedings, Darrell's attorney told the family,
"I think we're making some progress," slapping Harry on the shoulder. "You're on tomorrow," he said.
It was not a restful night for Harry. When the questioning began the next morning, Harry was understandably nervous about the whole process.
"Mr. Maxwell," Darrell's attorney began, "there's a reason why I called you as the last witness for the defense. You and I both know why. Will you please share that reason with the good people of the jury?"
because I know without a doubt that Darrell didn't commit the crime. The attorney, nodding solemnly, as if Harry had uttered a great truth.
Everyone who's testified for the defense shares that point of view, Mr. Maxwell. Why would your opinion be more relevant than theirs?
Harry said, because Darrell was with me on the morning of Claire's death. The jury, exhibiting no noticeable shock upon hearing this piece of testimony for the first time. A little disappointing to Darrell's attorney, but he soldiered on.
Well, can you elaborate for us, Mr. Maxwell?
And Harry told his story. The dream of the sports bar they hoped to open. The time they spent looking over the property, the town, the surrounding area. Darrell's attorney established that the drive to and from Eagleton was 2 hours, give or take. They spent an hour surveying the property, another hour looking over the town and the surrounding area.
About 4 hours in all, he concluded.
Yes, Harry said.
You began your trip around, what, 8 in the morning, and got back around noon?
About 12:30, yes, sir.
And you may recall from previous testimony presented by the prosecution, this is within the time frame that they have put forward as the time of Mrs. Bryant's death,
Harry said. As I understand it,
no further questions.
The prosecutor cross-examined. Do either of you or Mr. Bryant have any experience in the restaurant industry?
No, we were planning to hire a manager.
Did a realtor accompany you on this outing?
Nope. This was just an idea we've been kicking around. We hadn't made any decisions, so we weren't ready to involve a realtor.
Anyone in your family know about this trip?
No.
Anyone in the family know anything at all about this sports bar idea?
Well, we didn't want to bring it up until we were sure we could make it happen. We decided not to tell anyone about it until we had reached a decision to move forward with it.
The prosecutor took a thoughtful moment to digest what Harry had said.
You testified that you spent a few hours looking over the property.
The town?
Yes.
Did you stop anywhere other than the property during those several hours?
No.
Didn't have a cup of coffee? Didn't ask for directions? Go into any of the business establishments to look them over?
No, we didn't.
On this fact-finding excursion, spending all that time up there to look things over, and you didn't go anywhere in town, maybe ask a few questions of the businesses there, the citizens?
We did not.
The prosecutor exhibited a look of surprise, shaking his head, giving a shrug for the benefit of the jury.
So, Mr. Maxwell, there's no one in that town or near the property you were looking over who could say that they saw you there?
No, I guess not.
I don't think so either, Mr. Maxwell. No further questions.
The issue of the time at which the crime had been committed had become more problematical for the prosecution in the aftermath of Harry's testimony. In the coroner's original appearance on the stand, he had estimated the time of death as sometime on Saturday, October 18th, more vaguely stated than a typical coroner's testimony. Darrell's attorney had had no questions of the coroner at that time, surprising the prosecutor, the judge, and probably the jury. But Darrell's attorney had now recalled the coroner to the stand.
It's a difficult task, isn't it? Establishing a time of death,
Darrell's attorney, commiserating with the coroner about the challenge of facing such a situation.
It's never easy, the coroner smiled. It varies depending on the circumstances of the situation.
And the circumstances in this particular case. The victim, missing for over 48 hours, out in the woods, exposed to the elements, wild animals roaming the area. I can see that it might be real difficult to determine an exact time of death.
The coroner saying, well, as I have testified, it was an estimate.
An estimate, Darrell's attorney repeated, his tone implying that he'd never considered that possibility.
Given all these elements in play regarding the circumstances of the discovery of the victim's body, you're confirming that it would be difficult to determine the exact time of death.
Yes.
Even might be irresponsible to try to do so?
The coroner shaking his head in disagreement, considering his response.
Yet, that's exactly what you did. In the official report filed with the state, that same report submitted to the court in which now,
and with a flourish, Darrell's attorney withdrew a copy of the document from the briefcase at his desk,
I am submitting as Defense Exhibit A.
The judge briefly examined the document and handed it over to the clerk. The prosecutor gave it a perfunctory once-over as well. Darrell's attorney asked the coroner,
Do you recall what time you listed on that official document as the time of death?
Well, looking for some help from the prosecutor, but not receiving any, as I've noted several times, it was an estimate.
If it were that difficult to determine, why would you even attempt it?
The state requires that an estimate as to the time of death be included on the coroner's report.
Have you ever filed a report in which you noted that an exact time of death could not be determined?
A hesitation. I believe I might have, yeah.
But not in this case, Darrell's attorney said. You went on the record with your estimate. It is now indelibly imprinted on the record of this trial.
Darrell's attorney didn't add this caveat. And more importantly, it will be indelibly imprinted on the minds of the jurors.
I ask again, what time did you note on your report?
I'm not certain that I recall exactly.
Darrell's attorney picked the recently submitted Exhibit A off the clerk's table.
Does 10 a.m. sound about right?
I don't believe I heard you mention that specific time in your testimony. Well, as I've said, it was an estimate.
Your professional and official estimate.
No response.
And coincidentally, Darrell's attorney concluded, a time during which my client and his brother-in-law were some 60 miles away, had been for over 2 hours, were there at least 2 hours more.
A stern look at the coroner, then the jury.
No further questions.
Score a point for the defense. But alas, not enough to save Darrell. Darrell's attorney tried to explain it to the family.
Well, it just seemed as if he wasn't engaged in the process. No emotion, no energy. We were fighting for this man's life, and he looked as if he were watching a boring movie. I tried to snap him out of it, but it's like every day there at the defense table, I was sitting with a man who was thinking about something else. I don't think the jury could connect to that.
The family had about as much enthusiasm for the attorney's explanation as Darrell had exhibited at the trial. Darrell's attorney shrugged.
Well, we'll appeal, of course.
Harry visited Darrell in prison. He promised himself, promised the family, promised Darrell, he would do it regularly, maybe on a monthly basis. Harry, still feeling some responsibility that his testimony, as compelling as it was, somehow fell short. But as the years slipped by, the time between Harry's visits expanded to every few months, then maybe twice a year. Harry tried to put up a positive front, but Darrell had changed, become more sullen, snarky, almost rude to one of the few people who even bothered to try to stay in touch. Harry, attempting to give him the benefit of the doubt, after all, the man was in prison. But he found himself looking for reasons to avoid the trip that he'd never really wanted to make in the first place. The last visit had just about done it for him.
You have a lot of time to think, Darrell had said. Yeah, I'm here in prison. Harry said, yeah, I guess there's a bright side to everything if you look hard enough.
A lame attempt at humor,
falling flat with Darrell. Darrell said, "You think about a lot of things. What else are you going to do?" Harry didn't have any suggestions, so he just nodded. Darrell looking at him, Harry becoming a little uncomfortable with the intensity of his gaze and the silence. Darrell not saying anything, as if expecting Harry to come up with something. So Harry said, "Well, looks like it's going to be another strong year for Clemson." "I almost told him," Darrell said. "What? Told who? Told him what?" "About the alibi you came up with. You and I up in Eagleton scoping out the property." "I thought it might get you off," Harry said, accepting what he felt may have been faint praise, then realizing, "What? What do you mean you almost told him about the alibi?" "That it wasn't true." "Why would you do that? All the thinking I've done, you can really let your mind bounce off these concrete walls."
"I suppose so," Harry beginning to feel uncomfortable with the tone of Darrell's voice and the direction that this conversation was taking.
Darrell said, "Call me stupid. The idea didn't occur to me until I'd spent half a dozen years in here."
"What idea?"
"The alibi."
"The alibi?" Harry repeated.
"Yeah, the alibi.
It was a good alibi.
Like you told me, Harry, you need an alibi in a circumstance like this."
Harry, tentatively, I did what I could.
"And it was a good alibi, Harry, for me.
And also for you. We were both up there, as the story went." Harry left early that day. A headache, he told Darrell. He hadn't been back. Driving home that day, sorting it out. The longer Darrell spent in prison, the more delusional he seemed to become. At least, that's what Harry believed any observer who was objective would conclude. And who could fault the man? His wife brutally murdered, then charged with being the one behind the horrible deed, losing the respect he had worked so diligently to establish, the position he'd risen to in the business, the promise of an even more successful future. Instead, a life sentence inside an institution that offered no possibility of normalcy. Almost everyone in the place proclaimed their innocence. Harry believed Darrell's attorney had thrown in the towel years earlier, or he'd gone through the motions, asked for a retrial, but there hadn't been much energy behind the effort. The man apparently realizing it was time to cut the line and move on. But what if Darrell brought it up? The alibi thing? At this point, would anyone take Darrell seriously? Yeah, probably not. Still, it left Harry unsettled. He had come up with the alibi. As Darrell had so ungraciously noted, an alibi not only for Darrell, but for Harry as well. People might begin to suspect Harry himself, questioning his motivation for making up such a story. Perjury charges? Just before Harry had left Darrell that last time, the headache actually became a reality. Darrell had said, "I know you took Claire's death hard, Harry." Harry was surprised at the remark, but nodding, "Yeah, everyone who knew her." He hesitated, not wanting to use an inappropriate choice of words, "thought a lot of her." "And she thought a lot of you, Harry, more than anyone knew." It was at that point that Harry's headache became so intolerable that he had to end their visit. And then, several months later, Darrell had died. Heart attack. Harry shaking his head when he heard the news. We won't forget him, one of Darrell's brothers had said to Harry. No, we won't, said Harry, knowing for certain he never would. Claire, too. Harry would always remember how beautiful she looked that morning.
the morning she delivered that devastating piece of news to Harry. Harry, crushed by it, overwhelmed, angry. That scene running in Harry's mind like a film on a circular loop, it was enough to cause Harry not to sleep well, even all these years later. Even though he was indeed an old man who knew now that he never would.
Right, for our next story, I'm going to switch over to the big book, that Alfred Hitchcock Best of Mystery Compendium, a story written by Jack Ritchie, and it's called The Third Call. At 1:20 in the afternoon, I phoned Stevenson High School and got through to Principal Morrison. I spoke through a handkerchief over the mouthpiece. "This is no joke. A bomb is going to explode in your school in 15 minutes. There were a few seconds of silence on the other end of the line, and then Morrison's angry voice demanded, "Who is this?" "Never mind that. I'm not fooling this time. A bomb is going off in 15 minutes. And then I hung up. I left the gas station, crossed the street, and returned to the main police station. I took the elevator to the third floor. My partner, Pete Torgerson, was on the phone when I entered the squad room. He looked up. "Stevenson High School just got another one of those calls, Jim. Morrison is having the school evacuated. Again." "Did you get the bomb squad?" "I'm doing that right now." He dialed and completed the call to room 121, giving them the details. The enrollment at Stevenson was 1,800, and all the students were out of the building by the time we arrived. Their teachers, following the instructions we had given them the last two times the school had received phone calls, were keeping them at least 200 feet away from the building. Principal Morrison was a large graying man wearing rimless glasses. He left the group of teachers at the curb and came forward. "Well, the call came in at exactly 1:20, he said. The bomb unit truck and two squad cars pulled up behind our car. My son Dave lounged against the wire fence with a half a dozen of his buddies. He waved. "What is it, Dad? Another bomb scare?" I nodded. "And let's hope it's nothing more than a scare this time, too." Dave grinned. "Oh, I don't mind a bit. We are just going to have a history exam." Morrison shook his head. "I'm afraid that most of the students regard this as nothing more than a welcome break in the routine." Several more details of men arrived from headquarters, and we began searching the building. We finished the job at 2:30, and I went back to Morrison. "It was another hoax. We didn't find a thing." Morrison ordered the students back to their classes and then took Torgerson and me to his office. "Did you recognize the voice?" Torgerson asked. Morrison sat down at his desk. "No, it was muffled and indistinct, just as before. But it was a male voice, that much I'm certain about." He sighed. "I'm having the attendance records checked right away. Are you sure it's one of the students?" "Well, in a case like this, it usually is," Pete said. "A boy decides he hates one of the teachers or the whole school because he's getting bad marks. So he uses this way of getting what he thinks is revenge. Or maybe he just thinks the whole thing is a roaring joke." The attendance records were brought to Morrison. He glanced at them, then passed them over to us.
91 absences, about average.
Pete and I went over the names of the absent students. I knew that Bob Fletcher would be there, but it didn't matter. I hoped that Lester Baines had come back to school in the afternoon.
Fletcher's here, Pete said, but he's out, of course.
His eyes went back to the list, and Lester Baines was absent. We ran down the rest of the names, and then looked up and smiled.
Just Lester Baines, he's our boy.
Morrison had Lester's records brought in.
He shook his head.
Well, he's 17. No disciplinary problem at all, but he is absent a lot. His grades are pretty bad. He failed in 2 subjects last semester.
Pete was looking over Morrison's shoulder.
Do you know him?
Morrison smiled wanly.
No, a principal knows fewer of the students than any teacher.
Torgerson lit a cigar.
Well, this looks like the end of this one, Jim. You should be more cheerful.
I got to my feet.
I just don't like to see any boy get into trouble.
We drove to the Baines home. It was a medium-sized 2-story house, much like any of the others in the block. Mr. Baines was tall and blue-eyed. His smile left his face when he opened the door.
You here again?
Yep.
We'd like to talk to your son, Pete said. Lester wasn't at school today. Is he sick?
Baines' eyes flickered, and then he said,
Well, why?
Pete smiled faintly.
Well, same thing we were here for before.
Baines let us in, reluctantly.
Lester's at the drugstore. He'll be back in a few minutes.
Torgerson sat down on the davenport.
He isn't sick?
Baines watched us narrowly.
Well, he has a cold. I thought that it was best to keep him home today. But it wasn't so bad that he couldn't go down to the drugstore for a Coke.
Pete's face was bland.
Where was your boy at 10:30 this morning?
Oh, he was right here, Baines snapped, and he didn't make any phone calls.
How do you know that? This is my day off. I was with Lester all day.
Where's your wife?
She's out shopping now.
But she was here at 10:30. Lester didn't make any phone calls.
Pete smiled. Well, I hope so.
And where was Lester at 1:20?
Right here, Baines said again. My wife and I will swear to it.
He frowned. Were there 2 calls today?
Pete nodded.
We sat in the living room, waiting. Baines fidgeted nervously in his chair and then got up.
I'll be right back. I've got to check on some stuff upstairs.
Pete watched him leave the room, and then he turned to me.
You're letting me do all the talking, Jim.
Well, it doesn't take 2 for something like this, Pete.
He lit a cigar. Well, everything turned out all right. We won't have to lose sleep on this one.
He picked up the phone on the table at his elbow and listened. After a while, he put his hand over the mouthpiece.
Baines is on the upstairs extension. He's calling around. He doesn't know where his son is.
Pete kept listening, and after a while, he smiled.
Now he's talking to his wife. She's at the supermarket. He's telling her about us. She's supposed to say that Lester was at home all day and made no phone calls.
I was looking out the picture window when a blonde teenage boy turned up the walk and came toward the house. Torgerson saw him too and put the phone down.
Well, there's Lester now. We'll have to have a few fast words with him before his father comes down.
Lester Baines had a new sunburn, and he carried a rolled-up towel under his arm. His normally cheerful face sobered when he stepped into the house and saw us.
"Where were you today, Lester?"
Pete asked.
"We know you weren't at school."
Lester swallowed.
"I felt pretty rotten this morning, and so I stayed home."
Pete indicated the towel under his arm.
"Is there a wet pair of swimming trunks in there?"
Color came to Lester's face.
Well, around 9 this morning, everything seemed okay again. Maybe I didn't have a cold. I mean, maybe it was just an allergy or something, and it cleared up.
He took a deep breath. So I decided to go swimming, get some sun.
All day? Did you get hungry?
I took along a few sandwiches.
Who'd you go with?
Nobody. Just me.
He shifted uneasily.
Was there another one of those phone calls?
Pete smiled.
If you were feeling so fit, why didn't you go to school in the afternoon?
Lester's hand worked around the towel. I was gonna, but the next thing I knew it was after 1 o'clock. I couldn't have gone back in time anyway.
He went on lamely, so I just decided to swim some more.
If you were just going to go away for the morning, why did you take sandwiches along?
Lester's color deepened, and he finally decided to tell the whole truth.
I didn't have a cold today. I just stayed away from school. Mom and Dad don't know that. There was going to be a civics test this morning and a history test this afternoon. I knew I'd flunk them both. I figured that if I studied tonight, I'd be able to pass makeup tests tomorrow.
We heard the footsteps coming down the stairs and waited. Baines stopped when he saw us with his son.
Don't tell them anything, Lester. Let me do the talking.
Well, I'm afraid it's too late for that now, Pete said. Your boy admitted that he wasn't in this house today.
Lester's voice showed panic.
I didn't make any of those phone calls. Honest, I didn't.
Baines moved beside his son.
Why keep picking on Lester?
Oh, we're not picking on Lester, Pete said, but we're reasonably certain that one of the students did the phoning. However, all of the calls came during times when classes were in session, and that means that only a student who was absent could have made them.
Baines wasn't impressed. I'm sure that Lester wasn't the only student absent today. Pete conceded that, but went on.
The first of the three phone calls came in 18 days ago. We checked the attendance records at Stevenson at that time and found that 96 students had been absent at the time it was made. 62 of those were boys, and we talked to all of them, including your son. Your boy was home at that time with a cold and alone. You were at work, and your wife was attending the birthday party of a friend. However, your son denied making the call, and we had to accept his word for that.
Lester appealed to his father.
I didn't make that bomb call, Dad. I wouldn't do such a thing.
Baines met his eye for a moment and then turned back to us, his face expressionless. Pete continued.
The second phone call came this morning at 10:30. We went over the attendance records again and discovered that only three boys had been absent on both this morning and on the day of the first phone call.
Baines' face showed a faint hope.
Are you checking the other two boys?
We were about to do that, but then another bomb scare was made this afternoon, and we were saved the trouble. We went back to the attendance records. One of our three suspects had returned for the afternoon session and therefore could not have phoned.
What about the other boy? Baines demanded.
He's in the hospital.
Baines grasped at that. Hospitals have phones?
Torgerson smiled faintly. The boy caught scarlet fever while he was out of state with his parents last weekend. He's in a hospital 500 miles away from here, and the phone calls were all local.
Baines turned to his son.
Lester paled. You know I never lie to you, Dad.
Of course you don't, son. But there was doubt on Baines' face.
The front door opened, and an auburn-haired woman stepped inside. Her face was pale, but determined, and it took her a moment to get her breath.
I just stepped out for a moment to go shopping. Otherwise, I was here all day. I'm sure I can account for every moment of Lester's time.
Mom, Lester said miserably, it's no use. I played hooky all day today, and they know it.
Pete reached for his hat.
I'd like both of you to talk to your son tonight. I'm sure you can do much better than we can.
He put one of our cards on the table.
We'd like to see all three of you tomorrow morning at 10.
Outside, when he pulled our car away from the curb, Pete said, "We might find ourselves in for a hard time if they decide to keep lying for their son."
"Suppose it wasn't somebody from the school?"
"Well, I hope it wasn't. But you and I know that the chances are 99 out of 100 it was."
Pete sighed. "Oh, I don't like to see things like this. The bomb scare is bad enough, but what happens to the family now is a lot worse."
I checked out of the station at 5 and got home a little after 5:30. My wife Nora was in the kitchen.
"I read the newspapers that there was another bomb scare at Stevenson this morning."
I kissed her. "And one this afternoon. That one happened too late to get into the paper." She shifted the cover off the pot roast.
"Did you find out who made the calls?"
I hesitated a moment.
"Yeah, I think we have."
"Oh, who was it?"
"One of the students. A Lester Baines." Her face showed pity.
"Oh, what would make him do something like that?"
"I don't know. He hasn't admitted making the calls yet." She studied me.
"You look tired, Jim. Is something like this a little worse than usual?"
"Yeah, a lot worse." Her eyes showed worry, but she smiled.
"Well, supper's just about ready. Why don't you call Dave? He's out in the garage trying to get that car of his to run."
Dave had the carburetor on the workbench. He looked up.
"Hey, Dad, you look beat with the heat."
"Yeah, it was a hard day."
"Find the fiend?"
"Well, I hope so." Dave had the gray eyes of his mother. He frowned.
"Who was it?"
"Yeah, a boy named Lester Baines. Do you know him?" Dave peered down at the parts before him.
"Sure."
"What kind of a boy is he?"
Dave shrugged. "Well, I just know him to talk to. Seems like he's all right."
He still frowned.
"Did he admit to making the calls?"
"No." Dave picked up a screwdriver.
"Well, how did you narrow it down to him?"
"I told him the method we had used." Dave seemed to have trouble with an adjustment.
"Is he in a lot of trouble?"
"Yeah, it might turn out that way."
"What do you think will happen to him?"
"I don't know. He's never been in trouble before. He might get probation." Dave thought about that.
"Maybe he did it as a joke. I mean, nobody got hurt. All he did was stop school for a while."
"A lot of people could have gotten hurt," I said. "It wouldn't have been a joke had there been a real panic." Dave's face seemed slightly stubborn.
"Well, we have fire drills all the time. Everything goes off okay."
"Yes, and that's what I had counted on when I called. I didn't want anyone to get hurt." Dave put down the screwdriver.
Do you think Lester did it?"
"Well, he could have." "Yes, Lester Baines could have made those first two phone calls. And I had made the third." Dave was silent for a while.
"Dad, when the school got the first phone call, did you talk to all the boys who were absent?"
"No, not myself, but the department got around to seeing all of them." Dave had a faint, wry smile.
"I was absent that day, Dad. No one talked to me."
"Oh, I didn't think it was necessary, son."
"And I hadn't.
Other men's boys might have done such a thing, but not my boy." But now I waited. Dave spoke reluctantly.
"I was absent this morning, too."
"Yes," I said. He met my eyes, and that narrowed it down to how many boys? 3, I said. "But we discovered that one of them couldn't possibly have made the call. He was in a hospital out of the state." I watched Dave, and that left us with just 2 suspects, Lester Baines and you. Dave had trouble manufacturing a grin.
"Some luck, huh? I was at school this afternoon when the third phone call came in, and so that left just poor Lester."
"That's right, poor Lester." Dave licked his lips.
"Is Lester's dad standing by him?"
"Oh, of course. That's the way dads are supposed to be." Dave seemed to be perspiring slightly. He worked silently at the carburetor for a minute or two.
Then he sighed and met my eyes. Dad, I think you better take me down to headquarters. Lester didn't make those bomb calls. I did.
He took a deep breath.
I did it as a joke. I just wanted to pep things up. I didn't mean anything wrong.
I hadn't wanted to hear those words, and yet now I felt a pride that I had a son who wouldn't let someone else suffer for his own mistakes.
But, Dad, I just made the first two calls, not the one this afternoon.
I know. I made that particular call myself.
His eyes widened, and then he understood. You tried to cover up for me?
I smiled tiredly. It was something I shouldn't have done, but the father doesn't always think too clearly when it involves his son. And I was hoping that it might turn out to be Lester after all. Dave wiped his hands on a rag, and there were a few moments of silence.
Well, I guess I ought to tell him I made all the calls, Dad, Dave said. There's no sense in all of us getting into trouble.
I shook my head. No, thanks, son. I'll tell him what I did. And now when Dave looked at me, I had the feeling that somehow he was proud of me, too. We'll have supper first, I said, and then we'll phone Lester's father. A half hour won't make any much difference. Dave smiled wryly.
It will to Lester and his dad.
I made the phone call as soon as we got back into the house.
Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Keith Tyler saying thanks again for joining me, and tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.